Much worse was to come. Over the next 2 weeks, the number of homeless would soar to 500,000. Hoover, however, was in his element. He had a massive crisis to solve and the authority to instruct and deploy people from a multitude of departments and agencies. The Red Cross, Weather Bureau, Public Health Service, Coast Guard, Veterans Bureau, Interstate Commerce Commission, National Lighthouse Service, and at least a dozen more, and to interfere directly in the running of 4 large government departments, Agriculture, Navy, War, and the Treasury. No one short of the presidency had ever been in charge of so much at once. No aspect of the operations escaped his concentrated attention. He authorized the setting up of 154 refugee camps and provided exacting instructions on how each should be laid out and operated. Tents should be 18 feet by 18 feet and arrayed in ordered ranks along streets exactly 25 feet wide, with 10-foot-wide alleys between each 2 rows of tents. In fact, for practical reasons, mostly to do with terrain, such geometrical perfection was almost nowhere achieved. Amounts of food, types of entertainment, extent of medical care, and all other details of camp life were similarly prescribed, if not often followed. Rather amazingly, Hoover saw the camps as happy places. For many of the inhabitants, he insisted, this was the first real holiday they had ever known. These were people, remember, who had just lost everything. As in Europe, Hoover was not comfortable with the people whose lives he'd been sent to sort out. He particularly didn't like the Cajuns of Louisiana, who he thought were as much like French peasants as one dot is like another. Hoover was particularly exasperated at the number of Cajuns who repeatedly ignored calls to move to higher ground. One farmer had to be rescued 6 times. In Melville, Louisiana, when a levee on the Atchafalaya River gave way in the night, 10 people lost their lives because they hadn't left when told to, 9 from a single family, a woman and her 8 children. To Hoover, this was not so much a source of tragedy as irritation. "I concluded a Cajun would move only when the water came up under the bed," he wrote. The Cajuns, in turn, weren't crazy about him. Near Carnarvon, Louisiana, a man with a rifle fired on Hoover's party as it passed in a boat, then vanished back into the woods before he could be caught. The man's animosity was perhaps understandable. The party was inspecting a levee that was about to be blown up to divert floodwaters away from New Orleans, an action that was widely held to be unnecessary. Levee failures further north had already lowered the river and removed any immediate or probable threat to the city, but it was decided to blow up the levee anyway. 2 large parishes were sacrificed for the peace of mind of New Orleans businessmen. The city of New Orleans promised those affected that they would be fully reimbursed. They never were. As always, Hoover was a tireless self-publicist. He traveled through the South in a private train, which included a car exclusively devoted to press operations. From this issued a stream of press releases mostly devoted to Hoover's vision and hard work. He also made sure that every Republican senator received a copy of a magazine article praising him. To any newspaper, however small, that questioned or criticized his efforts, he wrote a personal letter of rebuke. Sometimes these ran on for several pages. Hoover boasted that no more than 3 people died in the flooding after he took control. One of them, an overcurious sightseer, he wrote. But in fact, it was at least 150, and possibly many more. In the end, his efforts were far from an unqualified success. Relief funds were often wasted or misdirected. Emergency supplies were usually entrusted to the largest landowners to distribute to their tenants, and some owners unscrupulously charged tenants for the supplies or kept them to themselves. Reports of abuses were frequently brought to Hoover's attention, but he dismissed them all. The refugee camps themselves were not comfortable places, and the food was often so poor and unwholesome that many of the residents came down with dietary diseases like pellagra. These were not matters that made it into Hoover's press releases. To the wider world, however, the Mississippi flood merely consolidated Herbert Hoover's reputation as a colossus and made it almost a certainty that he would be the next Republican nominee for president. "It is nearly inevitable," he told a friend simply. In the normal course of things, the Mississippi flood would not in itself have troubled Charles Lindbergh, but it happened to coincide with a broad band of turbulent weather that lay right across his flight path. A towering storm system darkened the skies over a huge area of the Midwest and Southwest, and sent tornadoes spinning like demonic tops across 8 states, from Texas to Illinois. In Poplar Bluff, Missouri, 80 people died and 350 were injured when a tornado tore through the business district. Elsewhere in Missouri, tornadoes claimed a dozen more lives, and many other deaths were reported in Texas, Arkansas, Kansas, Louisiana, and Illinois. In St. Louis, high winds caused extensive damage and killed one man, a Negro, the New York Times noted solemnly, who was struck by falling debris. In Wyoming, 3 people caught in a sudden blizzard froze to death. Altogether, the storm toll was put at 228 dead and 925 injured in 2 days. In St. Louis, on the morning of Lindbergh's arrival, the winds eased, but were replaced by heavy fog. Players at that day's baseball game between the St. Louis Browns and New York Yankees at Sportsman's Park complained that they could not see 10 feet ahead of them. Babe Ruth, in any case, saw well enough to hit a double and a home run, his 8th of the young season. No one yet suspected what kind of a summer he was about to have. The Yankees won the game 4-2. While a chill, damp fog lay over eastern Missouri, Chicago was suffering a scorching heat wave, while Colorado and the northern plains states lay buried beneath heavy late snows. Nebraska, bizarrely, experienced snow in several parts of the state, while the southwestern corner reported 2 sultry tornadoes. Never had weather been more unsettled and strange. Lindbergh seemed blissfully oblivious. If he had any trouble finding Lambert Field in the fog, he never mentioned it. In fact, he said nothing at all of bad weather in any of his published accounts of those eventful days, other than to note that he was glad of the storm system because it kept the other flyers in New York pinned down until he got there. That he was perhaps the only person between the 2 coasts bold enough to take to the air seems not to have occurred to him then or later. In St. Louis, Lindbergh showed off the new plane to the men who had paid for it, had a nap, wolfed down a plate of steak and 4 eggs at Louis' Cafe by the airfield, then took to the skies again, this time bound for New York. In reaching St. Louis, he had already notched up an impressive double achievement. He had become the first person to fly through the Rockies by night, and he had set a record for the longest non-stop flight ever undertaken by an American pilot flying alone. Now with the flight to New York, if all went to plan, he would break the record for the quickest coast-to-coast flight as well. Remarkably, this was just at the time when dense fogs along the East Coast grounded migrating birds and made the hunt for Nungesser and Coley futile. No airman in the eastern United States was going anywhere. Francesco de Pinedo, wishing to resume his stately progress around America in a replacement plane, tried for 3 days to fly to Philadelphia from New York, but was turned back each time by driving rain and low cloud. Logically, the weather that was keeping aviators grounded in New York ought to have kept Lindbergh from getting through, but the normal rules of life appeared to have been suspended where he was concerned. For the time being, at least, young Charles Lindbergh seemed to have acquired a curious immortality. Chapter 4. To a foreign visitor arriving in America for the first time in 1927, the most striking thing was how staggeringly well-off it was. Americans were the most comfortable people in the world. American homes shone with sleek appliances and consumer durables, refrigerators, radios, telephones, electric fans, electric razors, that would not become standard in other countries for a generation or more. Of the nation's 26.8 million households, 11 million had a phonograph, 10 million had a car, 17.5 million had a telephone. Every year, America added more new phones, 781,000 in 1926, than Britain possessed in total. 42% of all that was produced in the world was produced in the United States. America made 80% of the world's movies and 85% of its cars. Kansas alone had more cars than France. At a time when gold reserves were the basic marker of national wealth, America held half the world's supply, or as much as all the rest of the world put together. No country in history had ever been this well off, and it was getting wealthier daily at a pace that was positively dizzying. The stock market, already booming, would rise by a third in 1927 in what Herbert Hoover would later call an orgy of mad speculation. But in the spring and summer of 1927, neither he nor anyone else was worried yet. The America that Charles Lindbergh crossed by air in May 1927 was, as you would expect, a rather different place from the America we find today. It was, for one thing, more roomy and self-evidently rural. With a population of just under 120 million, the United States had only about 4 people then for every 10 it holds today. Half of those 120 million still lived on farms or in small towns, compared with just 15% now, so the balance was much more in favor of the countryside. Cities were, on the whole, agreeably compact. They had not yet acquired the radiating shockwaves of suburban sprawl that we find today. Nor, by and large, did roads of any consequence emerge from them. In 1927, when people traveled or shipped goods, it was still almost exclusively by rail. Paved highways in most places were a rarity. Even the great newly built Lincoln Highway, which proudly called itself the first transcontinental highway in the world, was continuously paved only from New York City to western Iowa. From there to San Francisco, only about half of it was. In Nevada, it was largely hypothetical, in the words of one contemporary, with not even roadside markers to indicate a notional existence. Other shorter through routes like the Jefferson Highway and Dixie Highway were beginning to appear here and there, but these were enchanting novelties, not true harbingers. When people imagined the future of long-distance transportation, it wasn't highways they thought of, but airplanes and giant dirigibles cruising between city centers. That was why the Ortig Prize was for an epic flight and not a road race. It was also why skyscrapers of the period began to sport pointed masts, so that airships could tie up to them. That this was patently inadvisable. Imagine the Hindenburg crashing in flames on Times Square, seems not to have occurred to any architect. Even in routine dockings, airships often had to discharge quantities of ballast water for purposes of stability, and it is unlikely that passers-by below would have welcomed a regular downpour of aquatic bilge. An alternative possibility for getting passengers into cities was the skyscraper aerodrome, with runways cantilevered outward from lofty rooftops or shared between buildings. One visionary architect came up with a plan to build a kind of giant table, with skyscrapers for the 4 legs and a 4-acre landing platform perched across them. The New York Times, for its part, imagined a more personal approach. The helicopter and gyroscope will enable a man to land and start from a shelf outside his dwelling window, it stated with hopeful conviction in an editorial on the coming future. That none of this was in any respect achievable, in terms of engineering, architecture, aeronautics, financing, safety, building codes, or any other consideration, seemed hardly to matter. This was an age that didn't like practical concerns to get in the way of its musings. A writer in the popular Science and Invention magazine confidently forecast that people of all ages would soon be traveling, and briskly, on motorized roller skates, while Harvey W. Corbett, a prominent architect, predicted that skyscrapers would rise hundreds of stories into the clouds and that people living on the upper levels would get their meals by radio, without explaining exactly how he imagined that would work. Rodman Wanamaker, the department store magnate and financier of Richard Byrd's flight, sponsored an exhibition in New York called The Titan City, that depicted a future world in which magnificent urban towers were connected by sleek aerial expressways, while citizens were shot through glass tubes in pneumatic trains or glided regally from place to place on moving walkways. Whatever the future held, everyone agreed that it would be technologically advanced, American-led, and thrilling. Curiously, it was the present that people weren't so certain about. The First World War had left in its wake a world that nearly everyone thought shallow, corrupt, and depraved, even those who were enjoying it for those very reasons. Prohibition was in its 8th year and was a spectacular failure. It had created a world of gangsters and rattling Tommy guns and turned ordinary citizens into criminals. New York had more saloons now than it had had before Prohibition, and drinking remained so transparently prevalent that the mayor of Berlin, on a visit, reportedly asked Mayor Jimmy Walker when Prohibition was to begin. The Metropolitan Life Insurance Corporation reported in 1927 that more people were dying of alcohol-related causes now than at any time before Prohibition was introduced. Moral decline was evident everywhere, even on the dance floor. The tango, shimmy, and Charleston, with their insistent beats and flapping of limbs, had a hint of sexual frenzy that many an anxious elder found alarming. Worse was a popular dance called the Black Bottom, which involved hopping forward and backward and slapping the rump, an act of scandalous abandon focused on a body part that many would rather didn't exist at all. Even the hesitation waltz was deemed to contain some element of sultriness that made it tantamount to musical foreplay. Worst of all was jazz, which was widely held to be a springboard for drug-taking and promiscuity. "Does jazz put the sin in syncopation?" asked an article in the Ladies' Home Journal. "You bet it did," was the answer. An editorial in the New York American called jazz a pathological, nerve-irritating, sex-exciting music. Many were dismayed to realize that America now had the highest divorce rate in the world after the Soviet Union. To cash in on this, Nevada in 1927 slashed the residency requirement for divorce in the state to 3 months, and in so doing became the home of the quickie divorce. Concern was greatest for young women, who seemed everywhere to have abandoned themselves to sordid habits. They smoked, drank, rouged their shining faces, bobbed their hair, which is to say cut it short and of even length all the way round, and clad themselves in silken dresses of breathtaking skimpiness. The amount of fabric in the average dress, it was calculated, fell from almost 20 yards before the war to a wispy 7 after. The generic term of the day for women of lively and liberal disposition was flapper, a word that originated in England in the late 19th century and originally signified a prostitute. It was an offshoot of that other avian term for females, still in use in England today, bird. The movies deftly caught, and often actively inflamed, the spirit of abandon that characterized the times. One movie, according to his poster, offered its slavering audiences beautiful jazz babies, champagne baths, midnight revels, petting parties in the purple dawn, all ending in one terrific smashing climax that makes you gasp. Another had neckers, petters, white kisses, red kisses, pleasure-mad daughters, sensation-craving mothers. It didn't take a great deal of imagination to discern a direct-line connection between the wanton behavior of the modern woman and the murderous instincts of a Ruth Snyder. It was often noted in newspaper accounts that the wicked Mrs. Snyder, before her downfall, had been a great one for going to hot movies. In desperation, lawmakers tried to legislate probity. In Oshkosh, Wisconsin, a local law made it an offense for dancing partners to gaze into each other's eyes. In Utah, the state legislature considered sending women to prison, not fining them, but imprisoning them, if their skirts showed more than 3 inches of leg above the ankle. In Seattle, a group called the Clean Books League even tried to get banned the travel books of Richard Halliburton on the grounds that they excited to wanderlust. Regulations of a moral nature were introduced all over the nation, and nearly everywhere were, like Prohibition itself, ignored. Among people of a conservative temperament, it was a time of despair. So when the spirit of St. Louis landed on Long Island, and from it stepped a young man who seemed to represent everything that was modest and virtuous and good, a very large part of the nation stirred hopefully and took notice. Up to this point, Lindbergh had seemed a faraway and vague rival, as Clarence Chamberlain recalled later. Most people outside aviation had not even heard of him, but he now rapidly became the public favorite. As a New York Times reporter observed just 24 hours after his arrival, Lindbergh has won the hearts of New Yorkers by his bashful smile, his indomitable pluck, and his impetuous flight here from the Pacific. Large crowds came to the airfields to see the person the papers were calling, to his extreme irritation, Lucky Lindy. On the Sunday after his arrival, 30,000 people, as many as would go to a Yankees game, turned up at Curtis Field just in the hope of catching sight of the young aviator as he talked with his mechanics and worked on his plane. So many climbed onto the roof of a small paint shop next to the Spirit of St. Louis hangar that the building collapsed under their weight. Luckily, no one was inside at the time, and none of those who fell were seriously injured. The two main airfields of Long Island, Roosevelt and its more diminutive neighbor, Curtis, didn't offer much in the way of romance. They stood in a dreary, semi-industrialized landscape of warehouses and low factories, interspersed with market gardens and characterless housing developments. The airfields themselves were strictly utilitarian. Their hangars and service buildings were rough and unpainted. The parking areas were potholed and overspread with brown puddles. After weeks of rain, the paths around the buildings were a shiny slick of mud. Roosevelt was much the better of the two airfields, thanks to money spent by Rodman Wanamaker on rolling and grading the runway since René Fonck's terrible crash there 9 months earlier. Footnote. The field was named after Quentin Roosevelt, son of Theodore Roosevelt, who had died in aerial combat in World War I. Lindbergh had known him, at least slightly. They had been students at the same time at the Sidwell Friends School in Washington, though Roosevelt was 5 years older. Roosevelt Fields was the only runway in New York long enough for an Atlantic flight, which could have been a problem, since it was now leased exclusively to Wanamaker for Bird's use. But Bird insisted that the other competitors be allowed to use it too. To his immense credit, Bird did everything he could to help his rivals. He freely shared his private weather reports, for instance. He was also one of the first to call on Lindbergh at his hangar at Curtis Field and to wish him good luck. Then again, Bird was by such a wide margin the front runner, and Lindbergh so obviously outclassed that Bird could afford to be generous. Despite the attention Lindbergh now received, most of the other aviators and crew didn't rate his chances highly. Bernd Balchen, a member of the Bird team, recalled in his memoirs that Lindbergh was generally assumed to be out of his class. The president of the American Society for the Promotion of Aviation stated frankly that he didn't think Lindbergh, or indeed any of the pilots, stood a chance. Compared with Bird's operation, Lindbergh's was indeed arrestingly low-key. Bird had a team of 40 people, mechanics, telegraph operators, even kitchen staff to run a private mess hall. Lindbergh had no help at all lined up in New York. His backers in St. Louis sent out a young man named George Stumpf, who had no relevant experience, in the vague hope that he might run errands or otherwise make himself useful. The Wright Corporation provided two mechanics to assist him with preparations. It did this for all the teams using its engines, in its own interests, and also sent a PR man named Richard Blythe to help manage the press, but considered Lindbergh such a dark horse that it made the two of them share a room in the Garden City Hotel. Apart from this, Lindbergh was entirely on his own. Bird's preparations were conservatively estimated to have cost $500,000. Lindbergh's total expenses, plane, fuel, food, lodging, everything, came to just $13,500. Though Bird was too well-bred to betray his thoughts, he must have been appalled by what he saw when he called on Lindbergh. He was clearly just a boy. He had no relevant experience. His plane had no radio and a single engine. Bird insisted on having three, and was built by a company no one had ever heard of. Lindbergh planned to carry no lifeboat and almost no backup supplies. Above all, he proposed to go alone, which meant flying a difficult and unstable plane for a day and a half through storm and cloud and darkness, while intricately balancing the flow of fuel through 5 tanks governed by 14 valves, and navigating his way across a void without landmarks. When he needed to check his position or log a note, he would have to spread his work out on his lap and hold the stick between his knees. If it was nighttime, he would have to grip a small flashlight between his teeth. Taken together, these were jobs that would test a crew of 3. Anyone who knew flying knew that this was more than any one person could do. It was madness. Several newspapermen tried to talk Lindbergh out of his suicidal ambition, but to no avail. "He won't listen to reason," one complained to Balchen. "He's just a stubborn squarehead." The atmosphere at the airfields, Lindbergh recalled years later in his autobiography, The Spirit of St. Louis, was decidedly tense. It was just over 2 weeks since Davis and Wooster had crashed fatally in Virginia, and less than 1 week since Neungesser and Coley had gone missing. Myron Herrick, the American ambassador in Paris, had publicly announced that it would not be a good idea for any American airmen to fly to France for the time being. Now everyone was pinned down by bad weather anyway. It was all very frustrating. Adding to Lindbergh's personal strain was a growing uneasiness with the press. Reporters persisted in asking him personal questions that had nothing to do with flying. Did he have a sweetheart? Did he like dancing? Which he found embarrassing and intrusive. And photographers couldn't understand why he wouldn't let them take pictures of him relaxing or horsing around with the other flyers or mechanics. They were just trying to make him look normal, after all. At one point, two of them burst into his room at the Garden City Hotel, hoping to catch him shaving or reading or something that would suggest a kind of likable boyish normality. On May 14th, Charles's mother arrived from Detroit to wish him a safe journey. Reluctantly, they posed for pictures, standing stiffly side by side like two people who had only just been introduced. Mrs. Lindbergh declined all pleas to kiss or embrace her son, explaining that they came from an undemonstrative Nordic race, which in her case was wholly untrue. Instead, she patted her son lightly on the back and said, "Good luck, Charles," then added as an ominous afterthought, "and goodbye." The Evening Graphic, undeterred by their shyness, created a touching composograph for its readers, in which Charles's and his mother's heads were pasted onto the bodies of more demonstrative models, though no art director could do anything about the strange, flat absence of emotion in mother and son's eyes. All three American competitors, Lindbergh in The Spirit of St. Louis, Bird with the America, Chamberlain and Acosta in Belanca's Columbia, were reported as ready to go, so it was widely assumed that they would leave together the moment the weather cleared and that the Atlantic crossing would now be an exciting three-way race. In fact, unbeknown to Lindbergh and the rest of the world, things were not going well in the other two camps. Bird seemed strangely reluctant to commit to the Paris flight. He endlessly tested and retested every system of the plane, to the mystification of his crew and the hair-rending exasperation of Tony Fokker, the plane's volatile designer. "It seemed to me that every possible excuse for delay was seized on," Fokker recalled in his autobiography 4 years later. "I began to wonder whether Bird really wanted to make the transatlantic flight." To everyone's surprise, Bird set the plane's formal dedication, with droning speeches and the plane draped in bunting, for Saturday, May 21st, which meant that he couldn't go before the weekend, even if the weather allowed. In the Columbia camp, matters were even more unhappy, and all because of the difficult and truculent nature of Charles A. Levine. The son of a scrap merchant, Levine had made his own fortune after the Great War by buying and selling scrap shell casings, which could be recycled for their brass. After developing an interest in aviation, he became known, all but inevitably, as the Flying Junkman. By 1927, he claimed to be worth $5 million, though many who had seen his modest frame home in the Bell Harbor section of Rockaway, at the less genteel end of Long Island real estate, suspected that was an exaggeration. Levine was bald, pugnacious, stockily built, and about 5'6" tall. He dressed like a gangster, in heavily pinstriped double-breasted suits and broad-brimmed hats. He had the quick mind and alert, roving gaze of a man always on the lookout for an opportunity. His smile was a grimace. He had recently celebrated his 30th birthday. His two greatest personality faults were a pathological inability to be frank with anyone, Levine seemed sometimes to be lying simply for the sake of it, and an equal difficulty in distinguishing legal activities from illegal ones. He had a fatal tendency to alienate and often cheat his business associates. In consequence, he constantly ended up in court. It was legal problems that would prove his undoing now. Levine's immediate difficulty was that he couldn't stand his chief pilot, Clarence Chamberlain. This was a rather odd sentiment, since Chamberlain was a decent, amiable fellow and a first-rate flyer. He just lacked sparkle. The liveliest thing about him was his dress sense. He favored snappy bow ties and intensely patterned argyle socks paired with capacious knickerbockers, but in all other respects, he was almost painfully retiring. Exasperated by Chamberlain's lack of dynamism, Levine openly maneuvered to replace him as chief pilot. "He wanted to eliminate me because I was not a movie type and would not film well after the big adventure," Chamberlain recalled cheerfully in his autobiography. Over the objections of Giuseppe Belanca, who liked and admired Chamberlain very much, Levine chose Lloyd Berto, a burly, more outgoing type, to be chief pilot. Berto was unquestionably a good pilot and a fearless one. As a boy in California, he had built his own glider and tested it, successfully, though none too prudently, by jumping off a high sea cliff. He was also a great publicity hound. His most inspired stunt was to get married while piloting a plane. A pastor crashed between him and his obliging bride. These impulses naturally endeared him to Levine. So Berto now joined the Columbia team. Since Bert Acosta was also on the team, this meant that Levine had more pilots than he had space for in his airplane. Levine called Acosta and Chamberlain together and informed them that he hadn't made his mind up which of them would fly to Paris as Berto's co-pilot. He would decide with a toss of a coin on the morning of the flight. Acosta stared at him in disbelief for a long moment, then crossed the airfield and joined the Bird team. Berto thereupon declared that he didn't want Chamberlain with him in any case, and endeavored to have his own co-pilot appointed. Blanca said he would not let his plane take off without Chamberlain aboard. Giuseppe Blanca was 41 years old in 1927, which made him considerably senior to nearly everyone else involved in the Atlantic flights. Small, just 5'1", reserved and kindly, he had grown up in Sicily, the son of a flour mill owner, and studied engineering at the Technical Institute in Milan, where he developed an interest in aviation. In 1911, Blanca emigrated with his large family, parents and 8 brothers and sisters, to Brooklyn. In the basement of their new house, he built a plane. His mother sewed the linen fabric, his father helped with the carpentry. He then took it to a field and taught himself to fly, taking short, cautious hops at first, then gradually increasing them in distance and duration until he was actually, properly, airborne. Blanca was a brilliant and innovative designer. His planes were among the first in the world to use air-cooled engines to enclose the cockpit for aerodynamic purposes, not the comfort of the occupants, and to incorporate streamlining into every possible aspect of the plane's exterior design. A strut on a Blanca plane didn't just hold up the wing, it added lift, or at the very least, minimized drag. In consequence, Blanca's plane was probably, for its size, the best in the world. Unfortunately, Blanca was a hopeless businessman and always struggled for funds. For a time, he designed for the Wright Corporation, but then Wright decided to get out of plane building and concentrate on engines. So, to Blanca's presumed horror, it sold his beloved plane to Charles Levine. Since the plane was the only Blanca demonstrator model in existence, Blanca the man had little choice but to go along with Blanca the plane, and so began his brief, unhappy connection to Charles Levine. All the parties on the Levine team now squabbled endlessly. Levine insisted that the plane should carry a radio, not for safety, but so that the flyers could send reports to passing ships, which he could then sell profitably to newspapers. To make such contact easier, Levine wanted the Columbia to follow the principal shipping lanes rather than the Great Circle route, adding distance as well as danger to the enterprise. Blanca, normally a mild man, responded furiously. A radio, he argued, would add weight that they could ill afford, presented a fire hazard, and had great potential to interfere with the plane's compasses. In any case, the men aboard the plane would be too busy flying it to write jolly accounts of their adventures for newspapers. On at least 4 occasions, Levine ordered the ground crew to install a radio, and on each occasion, Blanca had it taken out again, an operation that cost Levine $75 a time and left him in sputtering rage. Shortly before the planned day of departure, Levine made matters infinitely worse by presenting Berto and Chamberlain with contracts to sign. For weeks he had been promising to give them half of all earnings from the flight and to provide them with generous life insurance cover for the security of their wives, should they lose their lives in the crossing attempt. But the document he now presented mentioned neither. Instead, it declared that Levine would receive all monies earned, and that for a period of 1 year following the flight, they would cede to him total management of their lives. Levine alone would decide on endorsements, film roles, vaudeville tours, and any other professional commitments. From these earnings, Levine would pay them each $150 a week, to which he would add unspecified bonuses from time to time as seemed to him appropriate. When pressed about the insurance, Levine said he would consider it once Berto and Chamberlain had signed the contracts. Having just told Berto and Chamberlain that he was taking everything they earned, Levine informed reporters that every nickel of the prize money goes to the Columbia's pilots. Berto, exasperated beyond forbearance at Levine's endless duplicity, found a lawyer named Clarence Nutt, who took out an injunction enjoining Levine from sending the plane anywhere until the matter of insurance and a fair contract was resolved. A court hearing was scheduled for May 20th, a date that would prove to be fateful for all concerned. In a demonstration that there was almost no limit to his unpredictability, Levine now said that he would pay Lindbergh $25,000 to accompany him to Paris. Lindbergh politely pointed out that his plane didn't have room for a passenger. The upshot was that Lindbergh suddenly had the running all to himself, at least until the weekend, if only the weather would permit. He was beginning at last to win converts, too. After working with Lindbergh for a week, Edward Mulligan, one of the mechanics assigned to help him, rushed up to a colleague and, in a mixture of excitement and wonder, cried, "I tell you, Joe, this boy's going to make it. He is." Chapter 5. The weather remained terrible, not just in New York, but everywhere. In Washington, D.C., on May 14th, a tornado 50 feet across at the base touched down at Prospect Hill Cemetery and proceeded in an erratic fashion up Rhode Island Avenue, uprooting trees and causing consternation among onlookers before harmlessly dematerializing a minute or so after forming. Further west, unseasonably late blizzards caught much of the country by surprise. In Detroit, a Tigers-Yankees baseball game was postponed because of snow, the latest snow out of a Major League game ever recorded. Rains continued to pound the beleaguered central and lower Mississippi Valley. In Chicago, Francesco de Pinedo, having resumed his tour of America in a replacement plane, arrived more than 4 hours late from Memphis because of bad weather. His tour had become increasingly embarrassing to his hosts because his rallies were more and more overtly political and increasingly ended in violence, while Pinedo himself had a tendency to say strangely inappropriate things. "I think New York is the best fascist city in the whole world," he declared generously but bewilderingly after meeting with Mayor Jimmy Walker. 2 days later, when Pinedo addressed a fascist rally at an Italian Legion post on 2nd Avenue, 2,000 anti-fascist demonstrators marched on the hall. Bricks were thrown through windows, and most of those inside rushed outside and began fighting with the demonstrators. By the time police arrived in force, a crowd estimated at 10,000 had gathered. Police restored order by wading through the crowd and clubbing people robustly with nightsticks. Pinedo, meanwhile, continued giving his talk, seemingly unaware that he was addressing an almost entirely empty hall. The number of injured was not recorded. Chicago was the last of Pinedo's 44 stops in the United States before he headed back to Europe by way of Quebec and Newfoundland. His hope now was to steal a march on the Roosevelt Field aviators by getting across the Atlantic ahead of them. He couldn't qualify for the Ortigue Prize because he needed to refuel in the Azores en route, but it would still be a glorious symbolic triumph for fascism if he were waiting at Le Bourget, fists on hips, to greet with an air of cheerful condescension the first American flyers to get there. Happily, there were no anti-fascist demonstrations in Chicago, though ironically Pinedo faced serious injury from the exuberant backslaps and crushing embraces of several hundred black-shirted supporters who greeted him at dockside at the Chicago Yacht Club. One of those waiting to welcome Pinedo at the official reception was Chicago's leading Italian-American businessman, Al Capone. Even in Chicago, the most corrupt city in America, it was a little striking to see the nation's most notorious hoodlum mingling with the mayor, the local head of the Coast Guard, and several judges and other civic dignitaries. It was the first time Capone had been invited to take part in an official ceremony in his adopted city, the first time any gangster had been invited into society, so it was a proud moment for Capone. In fact, though he had no idea of it yet, he was just one day away from the start of his downfall. The person responsible for this unexpected turn of events was a slight, very remarkable 37-year-old woman named Mabel Walker Willebrandt. Until only a little more than a decade earlier, Willebrandt had been an anonymous housewife in California. But, growing bored with that life, she enrolled in night classes at the University of Southern California and in 1916 emerged with a law degree. For the next 5 years, she represented battered women and prostitutes, an unusually noble use of a law degree in the 1910s. She also, at some point, shed Mr. Willebrandt in a divorce. She so distinguished herself that in 1921 she was brought to Washington and made Assistant Attorney General in the Harding administration. This made her the most senior woman in the federal government. She was given special responsibility for enforcing prohibition and income tax laws. It was a wonderfully prescient, if inadvertent, combination of roles, because it led her to hit on an ingenious way to tackle organized crime. Until now, mobsters had seemed invincible. They couldn't be prosecuted for murder or other serious crimes because no one was ever brave enough to testify against them. It was almost impossible to connect them to their illicit businesses because they never put their names to contracts or other incriminating documents. Willebrand, however, was struck by the thought that mobsters were always demonstrably rich and yet never filed an income tax return. She decided to go for them on those grounds. Prosecuting criminals for tax evasion is such a common ploy now that it is easy to overlook how brilliantly original, how completely, stunningly out of left field the idea was when she first came up with it. Many judicial authorities thought it was completely insane. The man she targeted as a kind of specimen case was a bootlegger in South Carolina named Manly Sullivan. Lawyers for Sullivan argued that criminals could not file tax returns without incriminating themselves, and that would be a breach of their Fifth Amendment rights. The lawyers also maintained that in claiming a share of the illegal profits, the government would make itself an accessory to the original crime, a breach of its fiduciary responsibilities. The person most implacably opposed to Willebrand's strategy was a federal appeals court judge named Martin Thomas Manton. It is hard to conceive of Congress ever having had in mind that the government be paid a part of the income, gains, or profits derived from successfully carrying on this crime, he wrote. It is incredible to believe that it was intended that a bootlegger be dignified as a taxpayer for his illegal profit, so that the government may accept his money for governmental purposes, as it accepts the money of the honest merchant taxpayer. Despite Manton's objections, and those of many others, the case went all the way to the Supreme Court. Formerly known as United States v. Sullivan, 274, U.S. 259, it was scheduled to be decided by the court on the 16th of May, 1927, the day after Capone met Pinedo in Chicago. Mabel Walker Willebrand would argue more than 40 cases before the U.S. Supreme Court, but none would have a more lasting effect than this one, if she won. She did. By a neat touch of irony, indeed it would be hard to find a neater, the following decade, the opinionated Judge Manton was successfully prosecuted by the Internal Revenue Service for non-payment of taxes after he was found guilty of pocketing $186,000 in bribes. He served 17 months in a federal penitentiary. Thanks to United States v. Sullivan, Al Capone's days were numbered, though neither he nor almost anyone else realized it yet. The New York Times, along with virtually all other papers in America, barely noted United States v. Sullivan, reporting it in a small story on page 31, just as it paid little attention to another landmark Supreme Court case that month, Buck v. Bell, about which much more anon. Instead, it gave much more prominence that day to a brief but lively return to the news of Ruth Snyder and Judd Gray, who on the morning of May 16th were transferred the 35 miles from their prison on Long Island to death row at Sing Sing, in a scene of mayhem dazzlingly reminiscent of a Keystone Cops feature. A crowd of 10,000 people, many standing on rooftops or fire escapes to get a better view, gathered outside the Queens County Jail to watch as a motorcade of 14 cars, escorted by 6 police motorcycles with sidecars, each containing a policeman with a rifle, set off with America's 2 most popular murderers just after 10:30 in the morning. The convoy included prison officials, newspaper reporters, and 2 aldermen, James Murtha and Bernard Schwartz, who had nothing to do with the case but came along for the ride. They were accompanied by their wives and children, who seemed to enjoy the outing, noted a New York Times correspondent. From the jail, the procession drove at high speed, which in 1927 was about 40 miles an hour, over the Queensboro Bridge, then across Manhattan by way of Central Park, but it constantly got bogged down in traffic. No place in the world was less hospitable to a speeding convoy than New York in the 1920s. It was the most congested city on earth. It contained more cars than the whole of Germany, but it also still had 50,000 horses. The combination of hurrying motorized vehicles, plodding carts and horses, and lunging pedestrians made New York streets wildly dangerous. Over 1,000 people were killed in traffic accidents in New York in 1927, 4 times the number that are killed in traffic accidents today. Taxicabs alone were responsible for 75 deaths in Manhattan that year. In an effort to improve things, traffic lights had been introduced to Manhattan 3 years earlier, but so far had little detectable effect. Elsewhere, traffic improvements were being implemented where they could be, but in the short term, these just added to the chaos. Along Park Avenue, the leafy central esplanade was in the process of having 18 feet sliced off each side to add extra lanes between 46th and 57th Streets, thus taking most of the park out of Park Avenue. Along the west side of Manhattan, noise and congestion were further aggravated by the construction of the Holland Tunnel, which would open that autumn. It was a wonder of the age, the longest underwater tunnel in the world, but the challenge of boring and ventilating a tube 1.5 miles long, 100 feet beneath the earth, was so formidable that the tunnel's designer and chief engineer, Clifford M. Holland, dropped dead from the stress before it was finished. He was only 41, but at least he had the consolation of having the tunnel named after him. His successor, Milton H. Freeman, keeled over just 4 months into the job himself, dead of a heart attack of his own, but received no commemoration. 13 other workers died in the course of construction. To most New Yorkers in the summer of 1927, however, the Holland Tunnel was just a mighty disruption to traffic. So it was optimistic of the Snyder Gray motorcade to hope that it could somehow clear a way through the chaotic streets. Worse, because it was so instantly recognizable, whenever the motorcade stopped or slowed, people crowded round to peer through the windows in the hopes of spying the murderers within, slowing its progress even more. News of the convoy's arrival on a street spread like wildfire. Occupants of streetcars deserted their seats to rush out into the roadway, noted the Times reporter in a tone of some amazement. Matters actually worsened when the motorcade got moving. Many onlookers excitedly stepped into the road to try to get a better view, forcing the motorcycles to swerve dangerously. Several cars in the motorcade were involved in minor accidents, some repeatedly, often with each other, and the head of the motorcycle squadron, Sergeant William Cassidy, was thrown from his bike and into the side of the car carrying Ruth Snyder, causing her to shriek, but he suffered only minor injuries. Alderman Murtha's car overheated and failed to make it out of the city, to the presumed disappointment of his wife and children. At length, Snyder and Gray arrived at Sing Sing, where they vanished through the gates and off the nation's front pages. They would not be big news again until the following January, when their execution was set. Then came the most shocking story of the summer. On the morning of May 19th, readers of the New York Times woke up to this headline: "Maniac blows up school, kills 42, mostly children, had protested high taxes." The maniac in question was one Andrew Kehoe, who until that day had been regarded by everyone who knew him in his hometown of Bath, Michigan, as a sane and pleasant man. A graduate of Michigan State University, just down the road in Lansing, Kehoe farmed just outside town and was part-time treasurer of the local school board. He was so little suspected of anything untoward that a teacher from the school just the previous day had phoned and asked if they could hold a school picnic on his land. What the teacher didn't know at the time of the call was that Kehoe either had slaughtered, or was just about to slaughter, his poor wife. What is certain now is that Andrew Kehoe had become severely unhinged. A bank was about to foreclose on his farm, an act he blamed on local school taxes, and he was about to respond in the most chilling manner imaginable. In the early hours of May 18th, while the rest of Bath slept, Andrew Kehoe made repeated trips into the basement of the school, carrying boxes of dynamite and pyrotol, a military explosive. Altogether, he stacked 500 pounds of explosives throughout the basement. Then he wired them all together and ran a master line out to his car, parked out front. The following morning, children arrived at school as on any normal day. Bath's school educated children from every level, from kindergarten through 12th grade. On this day, attendance was slightly reduced because it was commencement week and seniors had been given the day off, but otherwise the school was full. At 9:40 a.m., a sudden and tremendous explosion blew apart the building's north wing, which housed the younger pupils. Witnesses say that Keo sat in his automobile in front of the school and gloated as he watched the bodies of the children hurled into the air by his diabolical plot, the New York Times reported in horrified tones. 90 children were trapped in the wreckage, many seriously injured. As the whole town rushed to the scene, Kehoe tried to detonate a second cache of explosives in the trunk of his car, but it failed to go off. Emery Hike, the school superintendent, struggled with Kehoe to stop him from doing any more damage, but Kehoe managed to pull out a pistol and fire it into the trunk, setting off another blast that killed him, Hike, and another bystander. Many others standing nearby were injured. Altogether, 44 people died that day, 37 children and 7 adults. 3 families lost 2 children each. When firemen and policemen went through the building afterwards, they were astonished to find that several stacks of explosives under the building's other wings hadn't detonated. Had they done so, the death toll would have been in the hundreds. By coincidence, just across the fields from Bath was Round Lake, site of a summer cottage where Al Capone was often to be found, particularly when he needed to lie low because of police investigations. Capone had spent the whole of the previous summer there. At the time of the school massacre, however, he was in Chicago, representing the Italian-American community for the visit of the aviator Francesco de Pinedo. Another celebrity familiar with the locality was Babe Ruth, who had been arrested the previous June just down the road in the town of Howell for fishing illegally before the start of the season. After the massacre, it emerged that these may not have been Kehoe's first murders. Years earlier, Kehoe may very possibly have murdered his stepmother. This unfortunate woman, his father's second wife, died in hideous pain when an oil stove she was lighting exploded in her face, covering her in burning oil. Investigations showed that the stove had been tampered with. Andrew Kehoe, still just a boy, was the only person who could have done it, but nothing could be proved, and no charges were brought. The Bath Massacre was the largest and most cold-blooded slaughter of children in the history of the United States, yet it was quickly forgotten by the wider world. Within 2 days, the New York Times had almost completely stopped covering it. Instead, like nearly everyone else in the world, it became consumed with the story of a young man from Minnesota and his heroic flight to Paris. For the next 6 weeks, on every day but two, the lead story of the New York Times was about aviation. Chapter 6. On the last night of his life that he could move about freely in the world, like a normal person, Charles Lindbergh agreed to a suggestion by Richard Blythe that they go into the city and attend a show. It was a great year for playgoing, the best ever on Broadway in terms of choice, if not quality. 264 productions opened that year, more than at any time before or since. Lindbergh and Blythe had about 75 plays, musicals, and revues to choose among. They decided on Rio Rita, a musical comedy in 2 acts, a good choice since not only was it a smash hit, but it was also in the lavish new Ziegfeld Theater at 6th Avenue and 54th Street, which was itself an attraction. The theater had opened in March and was an extravaganza of architectural opulence. Among much else, it boasted the largest oil painting in the world. Depicting great lovers in history, it was larger than the ceiling frescoes in the Sistine Chapel, and more agreeable to contemplate, as a reporter for The New Yorker dryly observed, because you didn't have to lie on your back to enjoy it. The new theater was so plush, many observers noted, that the seats were upholstered on the backs as well as the fronts. The plot of Rio Rita was interestingly improbable. Set in Mexico and Texas, it involved an Irish-American singer named Rio Rita, a Texas ranger traveling incognito while looking for a bandit named Kinkajou, who may or may not have been Rita's brother, a bigamous soap salesman named Chick Bean, and a character identified only as Montezuma's daughter. These characters, and some others of equal implausibility, engaged in a series of amusing misunderstandings interrupted at intervals by songs that had little or nothing to do with the actions that preceded or followed. A cast of 131 and a full orchestra provided a great deal of happy noise and spectacle, if not always an abundance of sense. Footnote. Casts in the 1920s could be enormous. A Max Reinhardt production of 1924, The Miracle, had a cast of 700. Plausibility, it seems, was not something that audiences insisted on in the 1920s. Katie Did, which had opened the previous week at Daly's 63rd Street Theater, involved a waitress who, according to the plot summary, falls for a dishwasher and part-time bootlegger who turns out to be the exiled king of Swavia. Stigma, by Dorothy Manley and Donald Duff, concerned a lonely professor's wife who falls for a handsome boarder, played by Duff, but loses her mind when she discovers that he has impregnated their black maid. Spellbound, by Walter Elwood, centered on a mother who poisons her two sons' coffee in the curious belief that it will discourage them from drinking alcohol, but with the unfortunate consequence that one son is rendered paraplegic and the other left brain damaged. The poor mother in despair runs off to do missionary work. Even by the forgiving standards of 1927, that play was so bad that it closed after 3 days. It wasn't all froth and melodrama, however. Eugene O'Neill produced his longest and densest play in 1927, Strange Interlude, which took 5 hours to perform and gave audiences an expansive, not to say exhausting, look at insanity, abortion, heartbreak, illegitimacy, and death. Audiences watched the first part of the play from 5:15 p.m. to 7 p.m., then had a break for dinner and returned at 8:30 for a further 3.5 hours of punishing gloom. In the event, Lindbergh's party, one or two others from the airfield had joined them, never got to the theater that evening. As they arrived in Manhattan, Lindbergh decided to check the weather forecast for one last time that day. A light rain was falling, and the tops of the skyscrapers around him were lost in drifting murk, so the phone call was really a formality. But to his astonishment, Lindbergh learned that conditions at sea were clearing and that reasonably good weather was expected. At once, they returned to Long Island to prepare for a morning flight. They had much to do, including getting his plane towed from Curtis Field to Roosevelt. Lindbergh fussed over the plane for a few hours, but late in the evening his mechanics ordered him to go back to the Garden City Hotel and get some sleep. There, Lindbergh was met in the lobby by reporters who had learned of his planned departure and wanted information for the morning editions. They detained him for half an hour with their questions. By the time Lindbergh finally got to bed, it was after midnight. He was just dropping off when the door flew open and George Stumpf, who had been posted outside to see that no one disturbed him, came in. "Slim, what am I going to do when you're gone?" he asked plaintively. A strange question, since they had known each other for only a week. Lindbergh spoke patiently to Stumpf for a minute or two, then sent him away. But it was too late, and he was too keyed up. In the end, he got no sleep that night. Lindbergh returned to Roosevelt Field a little before 3 a.m. A light drizzle hung in the air, but the weather reports promised clearer weather by morning. Fueling the plane took most of the night. It was a fussy process because the fuel had to be filtered through cheesecloth to remove any impurities, and all the systems had to be checked. If Lindbergh was nervous, he gave no hint of it. His manner was calm and cheerful throughout the final preparations. He packed 5 ham and chicken sandwiches, though he would eat only one, when he was already over France. He took 1 quart of water. At some time after 7 in the morning, Lindbergh folded his lanky frame into the cockpit. The plane started up with a throaty rumble and coughed out a cloud of blue smoke before it settled into a rhythmic roar, intensely loud but reassuringly steady. After a few moments, Lindbergh gave a nod, and the plane began to creep forward. After weeks of rain, the runway was soft and strewn with puddles. The Spirit of St. Louis moved as if rolling over a mattress. Almost all the other airmen and crews had arrived to watch. Fokker drove his big Lancia sedan, loaded with fire extinguishers, to the far end of the runway. Just beyond him, the spot where Funk had crashed 9 months earlier still bore scorch marks. Lindbergh's plane slowly gained speed, but seemed glued to the earth, as Fokker later recalled. The propeller had been set at an angle to provide maximum fuel efficiency in flight, but that meant a sacrifice in power at liftoff, and that deficiency was worryingly evident as the plane used up more and more runway without showing any sign of rising. Lindbergh, in his cockpit, had another concern to deal with. His lack of forward visibility, he now realized, made it impossible for him to be certain that he was moving in a completely straight line, something he very much needed to do. The plane had never been this loaded before. Indeed, no Wright Whirlwind engine had ever tried to lift this much. 500 feet from the end, it still hugged the earth, Fokker wrote in his memoirs. In front of him was a tractor. Telephone wires bordered the field. My heart stood still. As with Neumgesser and Coley at Le Bourget, Lindbergh's plane rose tentatively and came back to earth with a clumsy bump, then rose and fell again. Finally, on the third try, it lifted. It was, some spectators reported, as if Lindbergh had willed it into the air. Even Lindbergh viewed it as a kind of miracle. 5,000 pounds balanced on a blast of air, he wrote in Spirit of St. Louis. The plane rose so ponderously that it seemed to have little chance of clearing the telephone wires straight ahead, wires that Lindbergh could not himself see. He would learn of his failure from the sudden twang of snagged cables, followed an instant later by a crash no human could survive. Bernd Balchen, watching from halfway along the runway, was certain that Lindbergh could not make it, and cried out with relief when he just cleared the wires. He called it a masterly takeoff. Chamberlain declared, "My heart was in my throat. It seemed impossible. It took guts." Fokker predicted that Lindbergh would reach Europe, but would come nowhere near Paris because of the impossibility of navigating while flying solo. Bird was especially gracious. "His takeoff was the most skillful thing I have ever seen on the part of any aviator," he told reporters. "He is a wonderful boy." What most spectators remarked on afterwards was the silence. As the Spirit of St. Louis took to the sky, there was no cheering, just an uneasy quiet at how close Lindbergh had come to those wires, and how alone he now was in that small fabric-covered plane. The time of takeoff was officially recorded as 7:52 a.m. The spectators watched until the plane was no longer visible, then quietly dispersed in a contemplative frame of mind. From Roosevelt Field, Lindbergh turned north, passing over the great estates of Long Island's North Shore, before heading out over the misty gray waters of Long Island Sound at Port Jefferson. Across the sound lay the Connecticut shore, 35 miles away. Perhaps nothing speaks more powerfully of the challenge that faced him than that that was more water than he had ever crossed by plane before. Through most of that Friday, Lindbergh's progress could be followed fairly closely. As the Spirit of St. Louis sailed over Connecticut, Rhode Island, and Massachusetts, reports came in more or less constantly confirming his position and that he seemed to be doing fine. By noon, he was over Nova Scotia, and at mid-afternoon over Cape Breton Island. In Washington, Congress interrupted its proceedings for regular announcements of his progress. Everywhere, people gathered outside newspaper offices for updates. In Detroit, Mrs. Lindbergh taught chemistry at Cass Technical High, as on any other day. She wanted to keep the flight out of her mind, but students and colleagues constantly brought her the latest news. Shortly after 6 p.m. Eastern Time, Lindbergh passed over the last rocky extremity of North America on the Avalon Peninsula of Newfoundland and headed out over open ocean. Now he would be out of touch completely for 16 hours if all went well. Forever if it didn't. At Yankee Stadium that night, an audience of 23,000 people attending a fight between Jack Sharkey and Jim Maloney bowed their heads in a minute of silent prayer before Sharkey beat Maloney senseless. All across America, wherever people gathered, prayers were said. No one could do anything now but wait. For many, the tension was too much. 10,000 people called the New York Times asking for news, even though everyone knew there couldn't be any. In Paris, the possibility of Lindbergh's arrival stirred little sense of anticipation at first. Myron Herrick, America's ambassador, had no idea at all when he awoke on Saturday, May 21st, what excitements the weekend had in store for him. He planned to spend that Saturday at the Stade Francais at St. Cloud, watching his fellow Americans Bill Tilden and Francis T. Hunter compete against Jean Baratre and Jacques Brugnon in Franco-American team matches, a kind of warm-up for the coming Davis Cup tournament. A wealthy widower in his 70s, Herrick was a former governor of Ohio. Warren G. Harding had been his lieutenant governor, and now was a good and caring ambassador. He had matinee idol looks, silvery hair, excellent teeth, dapper mustache, and the kind of effortless charm that wins hearts. He had made his wealth as a lawyer and banker in Cleveland. In Paris, he endeared himself to the locals with his warm manner and deep pockets. In 2 years, he spent $400,000 of his own money on entertainments and improvements to the ambassador's residence. The match at St. Cloud offered a welcome and very exciting diversion, for tennis was a big attraction in 1927, and Bill Tilden was the greatest, and most improbably great, tennis player of the age. For the last 7 years, he had utterly dominated the game. Yet, curiously, before that, he had shown almost no special aptitude for the game at all. Tilden grew up in a rich and distinguished family in Philadelphia. A cousin, Samuel Tilden, had been the Democratic Party nominee for president in 1876. But his personal life was full of tragedy. All four of his siblings and both of his parents died before he reached adulthood. It was his older brother, Herbert Marmaduke, who had been the star player of the family. Tilden himself couldn't even make the tennis team at the University of Pennsylvania. But after his brother's death from pneumonia in 1915, Tilden decided to become a great player and devoted himself tirelessly, obsessively, and without the help of a coach, to improving his game. He hit balls against a wall over and over until he was flawless from every position on the court. When he emerged from his 4 years of intensive preparation, he was not just the best player in the world, but the best who had ever lived. Beginning at the advanced age of 27, he was world number one for 7 straight years and was not beaten in a significant tournament in the whole of that time. America, under his leadership, won the Davis Cup 7 times in a row. He won 7 U.S. clay court titles and 5 U.S. doubles championships. In 1924, he didn't lose a match, and in the summer of 1925, age 32, he reeled off 57 consecutive winning games. A feat as rare as Babe Ruth hitting 60 homers, or Joe DiMaggio hitting safely in 56 straight games. On the court, his grace was balletic. He didn't run so much as glide, and had an uncanny knack for being perfectly positioned for every return shot. It often looked as if the ball was following him around the court rather than he the ball. When serving, his favorite trick was to hold 5 balls in his hand, firing off 4 aces in a row and tossing the 5th ball aside as obviously unnecessary. His manner was arrogant and insufferable. He was widely hated by other players, but his skills on the court broadened tennis's appeal greatly. Tilden's career almost ended before it began. In September 1920, he was playing for his first national singles title at Forest Hills before an audience of 10,000 when a plane carrying a pilot and photographer approached to take aerial pictures of the contest. As the plane neared the stadium, its engine sputtered and then cut out altogether. For several seconds, Tilden and his opponent, Bill Johnston, and all the people in the grandstands watched in eerie silence as the plane, itself silent, headed straight for them. The plane just cleared the court and crashed in an open area a short distance beyond. The pilot and photographer were killed instantly. Tilden and Johnston looked uncertainly at the referee, who nodded for them to resume. Tilden served and won the point, en route to winning the set and match 6-1, 1-6, 7-5, 5-7, 6-3. It was the start of a streak in which he did not lose a significant match for 5 years. Tilden's unbroken run of achievement was made all the more remarkable by the fact that in the midst of it, in 1922, he suffered an injury that should, by any reckoning, have ended his career altogether. While playing in a tournament of absolutely no consequence in Bridgeton, New Jersey, he lunged for a ball and caught the middle finger of his racket hand on the perimeter fence. The injury itself was trifling, but it became infected, and 2 weeks later the top joint of the finger had to be amputated. Today the problem would be resolved with a course of antibiotics. In 1922 he was lucky not to lose his arm, or even his life. Calvin Coolidge's son would die from a similar infection the following year.